ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Jim Weatherby, former NASA astronaut and author of Controlling Risk, 30 Techniques for Operating Excellence. Over a 20-year career, he flew 6 times on the space shuttle, including 2 missions to the Russian space station and 2 missions to the International Space Station. In 1998, he was appointed as the Director of Flight Crew Operations, specifically selected to improve the flight and ground safety in the astronaut corps. Based on that success, Jim was selected after the Columbia accident to enhance the safety aspects in the organizational culture at the Johnson Space Center, home of NASA's Human Spaceflight Program. With 35 years of experience in high-hazard operational environments, today Jim consults with leaders and operators in dangerous endeavors with critical mission objectives. Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
We use a lot of military metaphors in media and in business. We plan marketing campaigns. We call conference rooms war rooms. We fight fires. But of course, none of that's true. We aren't at war. Most of us aren't fighting fires. What we do isn't rocket scientists. However, you have had a career where to say it's rocket science isn't really off the mark, and where lives were really on the line. And I'd really like to talk to you about the lessons that you've learned and the techniques that you can share with us as we encounter our own battles where it isn't life and death, but it might be career making or breaking. I looked at your website and you talk about how problems don't come out of nowhere, but instead send us signals before they happen. And it's critical for us to be able to recognize these signals. Can you talk a bit about your experience with accident and problem signals and how people who aren't in outer space can apply those insights to train themselves to be more aware?
Well, Gabriella, thank you very much for talking to me. It's a pleasure to be here. I love the premise of your initial part of your question. Though most people don't operate in life or death situations, you did say that it could be career making or breaking. Remember also that the decisions we make, the actions we take in our everyday life can destroy a company. I mean, the smallest things, the smallest mistakes that an employee makes can really destroy a company. And so even though it's not life or death, I try to talk about the principles of operating excellence because they can help everyone. So the meat of your question, you asked about signals. I often hear safety professionals telling people to try to identify weak signals of an impending accident. And I never knew what that meant. And after thinking about it for so long and being in life or death situations, I began to realize that accidents don't just happen out of the blue. Things just don't break simply. There's always what I call a divergence, or where normal or expected operations begin to change subtly. And that's what they mean by weak signals. If you know what to expect in your operations or your activities, and you begin to see subtle changes in what's going on, then that's called a weak signal. If you can identify it early, then the corrective action is almost always smaller, easier, and cheaper or less expensive than a correction later when the operation begins to really go off the rails. And we can talk about some specific examples, but I always encourage people to, first of all, understand their operations and know what to expect in a normal course of events, and then try to identify when things begin to diverge slightly.
Yeah, I'd love if you could give an example.
So it turns out of the techniques that I talk about, the principles-based techniques for operating excellence, one of the most difficult and challenging to master is this concept called recognized divergence. It is the most challenging one to do well. So an example of divergence is, let's say you're driving in your car and you stop at a gas station to fill up your tank. And on one particular day, you're in a hurry. You're rushing because you're late. You're behind schedule. But of course, your tank is almost empty, so you do have to stop. and you fill up your car. Most of the time, when you finish filling up your car, I would suspect that most people's brains are on automatic pilot, and you do successfully remove the nozzle from your gas tank and replace it in the gas receptacle, and then you get in your car and you drive away. But the very day that you're rushing and you're behind and you're hurrying is a day that your brain might be tricked into thinking that you did remove the nozzle, and you suddenly get in your car, you're behind schedule and you're hurrying, you turn the key on and push the button and you drive away, and the gas nozzle is still attached to your car. And I know a friend who this happened to.
Oh gosh. And
so it's the very
And I thought
time
my coffee was bad. Driving off of the hood of a car.
And it can happen to anybody. By the way our brains operate. So another example is you see all these tragic stories of people who leave their toddler in a car and they go to work for 8 hours and it's hot and the car, you know, the child dies. It's not a criminal activity. It's the way our brains operate. So the ability to recognize when there's a subtle difference or a change is something that we can learn, but it requires active volition to try to teach ourselves to recognize, okay, I'm in a hurry now. This is the time that I'm more likely to make mistakes. Recognize, you know, have the meta level cognizance to recognize I'm in a hurry. I call it's the voice that's up above saying to you, hey, I see you're in a hurry. You better be careful. This is the time that you're going to forget the key in the hotel room, or forget to look at all the drawers in your hotel room as you leave, or remove the gas nozzle from your tank because you're in a hurry.
So if I'm making a delivery on a media project and we're running behind, this is when we should take that extra step and really slow down to do our QC properly, because
exactly.
We're more likely to make the mistakes. So in your LinkedIn speaker series, you say that we should expect mistakes. Why? I mean, if we have mastered recognized divergence, why should we expect mistakes anyway?
There's a French philosopher whose name I forget, whose error is a function of being human. It's the way our brains operate. So we all make mistakes over a long life with a lot of various and relevant experience. We try to make smaller mistakes, but the problem is we still make mistakes. And so the trick is to know how our individual personal brains work and operate. You know, what's my personal proclivity to making mistakes? And you can only learn that through self-analysis and retrospection, and try to keep track of the mistakes you make. And we all make small mistakes. It also turns out that, and this is one of the more interesting or maybe even profound things about working in a dangerous business, it's kind of a conundrum. I realized one time before I was flying one of my, I think it was my last mission, my sixth mission. So I had a lot of experience. And I suddenly realized that when we're in space, all of us make mistakes, but in a dangerous business, the smallest mistake can quickly cascade to disaster. So the question is, how do we prevent even the smallest mistakes when we know that we all make mistakes? That's a very challenging question to answer, which we can get into the best way to attack that problem. But for the purposes of your question, first of all, just recognize that we all make mistakes, and the goal is to try to minimize the consequence of those mistakes, or do whatever we can to minimize the errors and make the mistakes smaller and manageable and easier to absorb.
So if everybody makes mistakes, and you've been in space all these different times, were mistakes made? I mean, did you ever have a situation where, goodness, a mistake is happening, but you headed off the repercussions of the past? And can you tell us about it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, mistakes are made all the time.
Ah, in scary.
If you want to be scared, think about this. The next time you jump on a commercial airliner, think about the statistic that is valid. We've done analysis and we've recognized that 4 out of every 5 commercial flights, a mistake is made by the flight crew, by the pilots up in the front.
No, I don't want to know that.
Typically, and it's not just one mistake, it's on average 2.3 errors per flight. But typically, so here's the good news. So now that I've scared you, I'll tell you the good news. Typically, it's a mistake in communication. And pilots have figured out over the years how to mitigate the consequence of Well, first of all, there's an error triad. There's three things you can do before the error is made. Number one, reduce the likelihood of making the mistake. So pilots use proper lexicon and terminology that helps them check each other. And so when I was flying, I could often hear a pilot or a ground controller say something incorrectly, but the other person listening, because we understand the proper terminology, can identify the error and correct the error before the consequence manifests. I hope that was clear.
What would be an example of that? Just because I'm not quite following. So if let's say, what would be a lexicon error ground control? What would they say that then you'd have, and how would knowing the correct thing head off a mistake? Like, what could be the consequence of them using the wrong term?
So the classical example will be a ground controller gives clearance to a pilot. For example, you're cleared for the approach runway 32 right, commence the approach at when you get to Angels 15, and the pilot reports back, Roger, clear for the approach 32 left. Well, in that readback, you've just heard the disconnect. The approach controller gave clearance for 32 right, and the pilot read back 32 left. So that's an easy one to correct. No, I didn't say 32 right. I said, or 32 left. I said 32 right, and make sure the readback is corrected. Then you know the recipient of the information knows the correct guidance or clearance.
Okay, right. So you would then, that highlights, oh, this is a miscommunication. We're going to read back to make sure that we've clarified it.
Right. That's the easiest one. But you can use this in everyday life. So you call on the phone and your spouse tells you, hey, stop at the store and pick up XX and X, Y, and Z. You don't just say, okay, I got it. You might say, okay, I understand you want me to get X, Y, and Z. It doesn't take that long, and you can verify that the recipient understood the command.
Right. What is error wisdom? You had mentioned error wisdom in your speaker series. Can you explain what that is?
So that's a term that was created by Jim Reason, who's a professor emeritus at the University of Manchester over in England. And he uses the term to mean, if we all understand our own proclivity, these are my words, so if I get it wrong, it's my fault, not his. If we all understand our own proclivities to making mistakes and our own weaknesses, then I have begun the process of developing error wisdom. So I know what kind of mistakes I make, and now I can devise tactics or strategies to avoid making those mistakes. A classic one is, for me, is messing up a file on a computer and either dumping the information or losing it somehow. And so over the years, I've developed a strategy for saving different versions of an important file where I simply add a suffix to the file name and I just increment the numbers. So this is, for example, my file errorwisdom-1. And if I make a significant change, I'll call it errorwisdom-2. If I lose -2, I can always go back to file number 1 and I haven't lost all the information. Using an automatic backup on your hard drive is also a way to correct mistakes that you make. Another weakness I have, and most people have this weakness, is what we call weak prospective memory. So it's the inability to think about something in the future when there's no intrusive cue to remind you. So my favorite example was a co-astronaut, another gentleman who would like to work out in the gym in the morning before he went to work, and he brought his bag lunch with him every day. And he didn't know how to leave it in the hot car in Houston, so he brought the lunch in to the gym, which was air-conditioned when he worked out. In the beginning of his process, he would, you know, the first couple of days, he inadvertently left his lunch in the gym, and he wouldn't remember it until 12 o'clock when it was time to eat, and then he had to drive all the way back to the gym to get his lunch. So from then on, when he brought, that's called prospective memory, the ability to remember to bring your lunch when you leave the gym to go to work. So from then on, he used the tactic of bringing the lunch in, but he put his car keys in the lunch bag, so he could not start the car without his lunch bag.
Oh, interesting. Clever.
So he had error wisdom. He knew that it was a weakness of his to forget his lunch, and he devised a tactic to help him remember it.
So I want to just go back to recognize divergence, because if we are in an ever-changing landscape, some mistakes are a function of unknowns. And so the divergence is almost constant. So how do you deal or prevent something that you've never encountered? And did this ever occur to you? Let's say your first time in space, you've never been there, you've trained tremendous amounts, but you've never actually been there. Did anything happen that you hadn't encountered?
Absolutely. And it happens all the time, especially in complicated businesses. Before I get to an example, let me just tell you that, well, I'll start with an example, but I won't explain it fully. I'll say on my very first flight, 7 seconds after liftoff, I had to make a very critical decision because something unexplained, unknown, unanticipated happened 7 seconds after takeoff, and I had to make a decision. Fortunately, I made the right decision. Now, let me back up and say the question you asked is one of the most important questions in all of any kind of operations, especially high-hazard businesses. You're touching on the holy grail. How do we prevent accidents that are unlike anything we've ever seen before? Typically, what happens in an organization after an accident is they do an analysis, an investigation comes in, they issue a report, rules are generated, new procedures are promulgated, and we tell the workforce, behave this way from now on so that we can prevent accidents like this. And typically, that works very well to prevent accidents that you've experienced or thought about or predicted. The problem is, as you correctly asked, how do you prevent ones that you don't anticipate? So this is the premise of my book. Rules-based procedures are only going to go so far. And I'll give you an example when I get to the end of this preface. We need to supplement rules-based procedures, which are closed and non-adaptive and apply to previous experience, supplement the rules with what I call principles-based techniques, specifically principles-based techniques of operating excellence. So these are the principles that we follow. Principles are more open and adaptive, and they apply to any situation, including ones that I have not anticipated. And I'll give you some examples because that's a lot of words to explain. But I'm just telling you, it's the holy grail of preventing unknown accidents, which is the key to being successful in our dangerous world as we walk around. So the prime example that I use, the most illustrative example, is most companies have a rule these days that you cannot use a cell phone, a mobile phone, when you're driving on company time. If you do that, the intent is to avoid accidents, obviously, and the distraction of talking on the cell phone. If you follow that rule, you will prevent most accidents in your car when you're driving, but you won't prevent all accidents. So I often ask an audience, what's a better principle that you might follow in addition to the rule that says can't use your cell phone when you're driving? And the answer that I look for is, and about half the audiences that I talk to get it, the answer is if you try to identify and avoid all distractions as a principle, now you can prevent all accidents. It might be the song on the radio or the conversation I'm having with somebody in the car or the meeting that I'm going to that's distracting me from thinking about the hazards that are on the highway or all the other drivers who are trying to kill me. So if I try to identify and avoid all distractions, that is, use the principles-based techniques of defensive driving, now I can prevent all accidents. And in, 47 plus years of driving a car, I've never experienced an accident. I know I could have an accident tomorrow or today when I drive, but I use defensive driving techniques. I don't just not use a cell phone. I try to anticipate all the distractions that I have and avoid them. And I try to anticipate the other drivers who are trying to kill me and on and on.
Right. I want to go back to those first 7 seconds. What was the situation and how did you apply? I'm presuming that you applied a principle to help you deal with whatever came up in those first 7 seconds after liftoff. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so it'll be a little challenging for me because it gets kind of technical, but I'll try to explain it to non-astronauts, which is, I'm presuming, all of your audience.
Yeah.
So there are 4 computers that are operating in redundant fashion to control the vehicle as it launches off the launch pad and clears the tower. 4 of them have the same set of software built by the same contractor, and they're all doing the same thing. And if one of them fails, the other three recognize it and they say, you're out of here. And they vote the guy off, the bad computer off the island, and on you go with three remaining computers. Well, in case there was a software error that was redundantly typed into all four of the computers, there's a fifth one called the backup that has independent software built by a different contractor that is watching what the other four are doing. It has no control, but the astronaut with our human brain can assess the situation right after liftoff and make sure that the vehicle is performing properly and going in the right direction. And if it isn't, we can push a button to manually throw all four of the primary computers out the window, metaphorically, and give control to the fifth computer and say, I want you to control my flight from now on. The way we assess the health of the system, the way it was trained, is we were supposed to watch what's called the eight ball, the gyro, the display right in front of our eyes, the attitude display indicator, and see that it does a proper roll, pitch, yaw program 7 seconds after liftoff. And if it is, you hear in the space shuttle area, you heard the term roll program, meaning the thing is progressing according to plan. So we lifted off on my very first flight, and I'm looking at that display, and I feel 7.5 million pounds of thrust under my butt that suddenly starts moving the vehicle in a roll, pitch, and yaw fashion. I mean, it's so much thrust, you can feel exactly the instant the vehicle starts to roll over and start to head off in the desired direction. And I'm looking at the eight ball, which we were trained to look at, and it's rock solid, not moving at all. So I had to decide, are the primary computers, which are displaying this attitude indicator, failing, and this vehicle is going where it's not supposed to go, or is the vehicle going where it's supposed to go and the display is wrong? Well, 2 seconds after that happened, and I saw it instantly, you know, and I'm the whole 2 seconds, I'm thinking, do I push the button or not? 2 seconds later, the display started to move and followed the proper trajectory. So I chose to not hit the button, which was the right answer. Well, so I came back after landing and I asked about that. And astoundingly, I heard the explanation, which nobody had ever told any astronaut before, as far as I know. That's expected because the computers take so long to process the information and send to the display, which is an analog display, and it takes 2 seconds for the signal to move the eight ball. Well, I was quite upset because, you know, why are you teaching me to look at the eight ball if it has a 2 second lag in it? If I'm supposed to make decisions.
Well, yeah, why not warn you? I mean, I guess 2 seconds is pretty critical, isn't it? I mean, 2 seconds is
death. That's an eternity under 7.5 million pounds of thrust.
Yeah. Bit. Wow. Okay. That's crazy. And it must have been.
What saved me was not just being slow. And what saved me was analyzing the situation and recognizing that the vehicle, you know, how does the system work? Well, the primary computers are controlling the roll, pitch, and yaw, and it feels like it's doing the right thing, even if the display is wrong. So I said, I'm feeling the right thing. Doesn't matter what I see on the display. I mean, we learned that concept, that principle of control launching on aircraft carriers. I started my career in the U.S. Navy launching on aircraft carriers. And at night where you can't see the horizon, the only thing you have to go on is your display and your gut feeling. It's not your gut feeling. It's scientifically, it's your neurovestibular system with the otolith and the semicircular canals that are telling you, you know, your internal gyros and rate systems that are telling you where your body's going. But at night on an aircraft carrier under acceleration, semicircular canal and your otolith lie to you because your internal balance was evolved over millions of years of operating in 1G on the Earth in the gravity environment. But if you're launching down an aircraft carrier under high acceleration, your brain is tricked into thinking you're pitching up when you're really not. And so you have to rely on the instruments. So when I learned that in the U.S. Navy, my first question was, well, what if the instruments are wrong? I never heard any other pilot ask that question, and I asked it in ground school my first week in the U.S. Navy because it didn't make sense to me. Yeah, I can believe the instruments, but what if the instruments are wrong at the wrong time? So the answer is you have to back it up with redundant, it's another principle, is redundant verification, but even more powerfully, dissimilar verification, where you're analyzing different systems that are independent and picking the appropriate answer. And that all can be done only with years and years of training and thinking about it. You can do that quickly in 2 seconds if you understand how the system works. So even though my previous 6 years of training at NASA were telling me one thing, in 2 seconds, I knew the vehicle is responding appropriately, even though the displays are wrong. I never would have come to that conclusion had I not asked that question 14 years earlier in the U.S. Navy, well, what do I do if the instrument is wrong?
Wow. So, I mean, you're not the only one there. If you had decided that you needed to make a change, to push that button, would you have had to bounce that concept off of somebody else, or would you have just done it? I guess my question is, how much should an individual be empowered to change the rule using the principle?
So that's another very good question, and it leads to yet another principle, one of the 30 that I write about, and it's called think fast and act deliberately. You know, you have to be thinking fast, but you better not be acting fast, or you will make mistakes. So, you know, another method that can save a crew is to do exactly what you premised in your question, which is bounce it off of somebody. Hey, I'm going to push the button. What do you think? No, don't push the button. And then you don't push the button. Or yes, I agree. Let's push. You know, and you can, on time critical things, you can really be even more effective and efficient in your communication and do it even faster than I just did. So yes, it is. It's almost always, you know, in space, there's a tendency to think you're traveling so fast that you have to operate fast. You know, you're traveling 5 miles a second up on orbit, but exactly the opposite is true. Because actions have more severe consequences, you better be acting very deliberately and doing things right and not acting too fast. Mm-hmm. That takes a while to recognize. So you hit it right. Right from my explanation. So congratulations on recognizing that.
So here's a question.
You could be a good astronaut.
Oh, that would be so fun and scary. I'm scared of heights, so I don't even know what that would do to me.
Well, so am I.
What? You're scared of heights?
Oh, absolutely.
Seriously?
I climbed in the vehicle one day. You know, you're up, the cockpit's up 195 feet above the flame trench, and the wind is howling. There's only 4 bolts that hold the whole stack on the launch pad. This is 2 hours before liftoff. And I look out the window, and the whole stack is leaning back and forth several feet, and it was really scary. So my solution was don't look out the window while I'm strapping in.
Yeah. That's funny. So thinking about procedures and rules, if you will, like when you're opening an airlock, for instance, following those rules, for certain things, is there ever a time that you would break the rule? I mean, or I guess that's question one. And then two, if we're always supposed to anticipate that something is going to go wrong, I know you had looked at the Deepwater Horizon, I think, and I'm curious if you can talk about that too. So do you always follow the rules, and how do you anticipate if something goes wrong?
Yeah, so it's another profound question, and I'll give you the quick answer. The answer is yes, you do sometimes violate the rule, but you have to be very careful about that. And it takes a long time to explain. I'll try to give you the quick explanation. And I'll preface this by saying, remember who wrote the rules? Other human beings. And so you can often see, I don't know how often, but in the space program where new rules and procedures are being generated for every flight, you could get up on orbit and find a mistake in the rules or the procedures. And so the technique becomes follow the rules thoughtfully. Don't just follow the rules blindly. You know, we had a saying in the space program, there's only 2 ways to get in trouble regarding procedures, to not follow them or to follow them blindly. So you have to have a lot of experience and really understand the system and how it is supposed to operate to figure out if the rule is wrong or the procedure is wrong. Now, having said that, there's other seemingly conflicting, but I think it's all, you know, when you really think about all these things holistically, you realize that there's synergies and they do make sense. One of the mistakes that was made before the Challenger accident was, remember, that was the one, it was a very cold day, and the O-rings and the solid rocket booster were not compliant or resilient enough to prevent the hot gas from escaping, and the vehicle exploded, or actually deflagrated. It didn't really explode. It deflagrated. It came apart, looked like an explosion. But the problem was not just the technical engineering violation of launching in violation of the rule that said you're not allowed to launch in temperatures, air temperature, ambient temperatures less than 32 degrees, which was violated.
That was a rule and it was violated. Interesting.
Okay. That was a launch commit criteria rule that was violated, but it violates a principle, a higher level principle that says don't ever change the rule in the heat of the day or in the heat of the moment. You know, do the conservative thing, cancel the launch, think about it, think if you want to change the rule later. Now, having said that, you know, that's a situation where you're on the launch pad and you can afford to make the conservative decision. Let me go back to the premise of your question. If you're on orbit, do you ever violate a rule? And I said the answer is yes, because rules sometimes have errors in them. But you have to follow a higher level principle. If you violate a rule, always default to the more conservative action. And in a time of war, or in a time of flying in space in a dangerous operation where you don't have time to think about it, you got to make your judgment call. But that's why we fly humans in space, because the human brain has the ability to use good judgment. Computers don't have judgment. They just do what they're programmed to do. But humans can use good judgment. And then I'll sum it up with the final caveat. And every military officer in the world understands the following statement that I'm going to make. You can violate a direct order in combat, but then you suffer the consequence of a general court-martial when you come back. And if you're guilty, you suffer the punishment, even to the point of death, you know, execution. But if you're right, then you're exonerated. So the point is, this doesn't really help your listeners too much. Right. Yes, you can violate the rule, but you have to be right.
Right. So you have to trust that you're right.
You have to be right. You can't just trust that you're right. You have to be right. Otherwise, you suffer the consequences and you've made the mistake and people can die. So there's a lot of principles that you can follow. And you're asking good questions that take a lot of experience. And in fact, it takes a lifetime of experience to really do the right thing. So in the beginning of your career, let me give you something useful. The beginning of your career or the middle of your career, the best thing you can do is don't just look at the rule and memorize the rule, but try to understand the rationale behind the rule, understand how the system works, give yourself the best possible chance of understanding why the rule's in place. And if you don't know any of those reasons, why the rule's in place or how the system works, you better follow the rule. And there's other ways to verify if the rule is in error, which we don't have time to talk about, but
I guess in an organization, though, if you don't understand the rule, if it's at all possible, I would think it is important to understand, because maybe the rule is outdated. Maybe it's just bureaucracy. Maybe you could be more efficient if the rule was changed. And so to understand the intent of the rule is probably important, I would, you know, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So if you can't determine that, then you follow the rule just because otherwise you suffer a consequence that is likely unacceptable.
Yeah. And a lot of times in organizations, rules are conflicting. Well, what do you do then?
Right.
You're told to do two different things by two different rules. Well, there's a procedure for doing that. It really is to, you don't just stop like most people say. You take the system to a safe condition, which might mean taking action to stop spinning hardware. And then you go to your supervisor and be willing to assist in improving the rule, et cetera. You always have to know how to get to the more to the conservative answer.
Right. So a lot of this that we've covered thus far has dealt really at the sort of organizational procedural. I mean, obviously it's individuals working within the organization, but I'm curious, because we can only control ourselves. You know, when you're in space, you're part of a team that not only works together, but you socialize together, you live together. And I imagine that eventually you get on each other's nerves a fair amount or could. How do you train to team effectively in that kind of environment? And are there lessons that people who, you know, aren't up in space can bring to their own work environment?
Oh, absolutely. And it's not as bad as Hollywood depicts it in many movies where crew members get antagonistic and there's arguments and on and on. I mean, it does happen. I'm not naive, but it's far less than you might imagine. In fact, one of the reasons I love the movie The Martian is because if you watch, that whole crew stuck together. They made decisions to help each other. They never argued or, you know, came to fisticuffs, whatever. So that was more realistic. Let me go back and try to answer your question. So at NASA, there are three levels of teamwork. The very first level, we do a lot of solo training. We learn ourselves. We learn what is my own strengths and weaknesses? How do I operate the system? Huge amounts of training working alone. It's only after you know your own weaknesses and your own strengths that we then get assigned to work with other people, where we begin to understand, how do I, for example, use the team to mitigate my weaknesses and use my strengths to help them mitigate their weaknesses to result in a higher performing team. And we do a lot of teamwork. You know, you mentioned earlier about the cold Lake Canada, the cold weather snow training that we did. We really are operating as a team under duress, which is when you really see if somebody has good leadership or teamwork or followership when there's a dangerous environment. That's when you really become a good team. But then the third level of expertise in a really high performing team is when the indications are you begin to see the individuals, the self begins to disappear. So I'm more interested in helping the team succeed than I am getting the glory of doing the operation myself. Or I'm just as happy assisting you if you're conducting the operation and I'm simply reading the checklist to you. I'm just as happy doing that because I'm contributing to your success. If that gives me just as great a pleasure as accomplishing the mission, then I'm on a high performing team. So here's another example you see a lot in politics these days. Everybody might act like they're listening, but they're really not. They're just rearming for their own verbal salvo. And they're not really interested in the other person's opinion. They're just screaming their own opinion. Well, on a high performance team, I'm much more interested in your opinion than I am trying to convince you of my opinion, because I have the humility to recognize I might be wrong and I might not have all the right information. So explain to me why you're thinking the way you are. Right. That's a real high performance team, when I'm more interested in your opinion than I am in giving you my opinion.
Right, right. Interesting. You used a word which I thought was pretty interesting. You said followership. There are tons of articles about leadership, but it is the rare article about followership. And I think that probably links into what you were talking about, the sort of esprit de corps that you get in a high functioning team. But what are some of the skills of good followership? What does that mean?
Yeah, so again, a good question. Thanks. It's probably the first and most obvious is I have to be able to understand the commander's intent, the leader's intent, and know how I'm going to help the team succeed in accomplishing the leader's intent. So I really have to be able to listen to the leader and understand what he or she is asking me to do, and then know how I'm going to do it, how I'm going to support the team. We've already talked about I have to understand the system that I'm operating with so that I know how to use the system properly to achieve the intent that the team is trying to achieve. I have to understand the overarching organizational mission as a follower. And by the way, leaders should take followership training, because then they'd be better leaders, because they'd understand what the workers are doing and how they're doing it. I have to be a good follower. I have to know when to speak up, when it's necessary to speak up. I have to keep thinking. I have to challenge either internally inside my head or externally if required. I have to challenge everything I'm being told to do and see, does this make sense? Does it achieve the company's mission or the overarching mission? How can I help? Is there a better way to do it? On and on. And then finally, in a short list of five things, how do I influence other team members to accomplish the goal of the team or the goal of the organization? You know, how do I, even though I'm not a leader, how can I, through my own actions or statements, influence other people to also follow to achieve a mission? You know, and think about missions, are whether it's wartime or in a company, missions are not won by the executives or the generals. They're won by the soldiers on the ground. And those soldiers have to know how to perform to accomplish the mission. And that's what followership is.
So I guess the last question, because I know you've been so generous with your time, the last question before we wrap up is the importance of attitude and confidence and how that feathers into that, and also how it relates to risk management.
Yeah, it occurs to me. I mean, every one of your questions is so profound. I keep saying, well, that's the most important question.
So I ask again, only I'm left the with, most important questions.
So I'm left with thinking, well, of the three things that organizations try to give their people or teach them, it's called the KSAs, knowledge, skill, and attitude. By far the easiest to impart or give is knowledge through training, and it's also the easiest to test, written test in a classroom. Skill is the next up on importance, and it's a little bit harder to give or to teach or help somebody develop a skill, which is the practical application of the knowledge that I learned in the classroom, but now I have to put it into practice. A little bit harder to assess, because now it has to be done in the field or in a simulator under real conditions where I'm assessing how does this person apply the knowledge and make the right decisions. And also the hardest to assess is a person's attitude. In a dangerous business, the person's attitude, to give one example, my risk attitude, what are my attitudes about risk? It's by far the most important predictor of success in an organization or in a person to achieving operating excellence. The attitude that somebody has, do they really go the extra mile and try to understand how the system works, or are they simply doing what I tell them to do? Do they really understand risk? And personal risk attitude is a combination of two things, my propensity to accept risk and my perception of the risk. And if those two are out of whack, either one of them, I'm going to be like a 24-year-old young male taking risk all the time, driving my car fast because I think I'm better than I really am.
Oh, you know my son. There you go.
Yeah. And so the risk attitude can only be assessed through conversations. You can also observe somebody's attitude or somebody's actions and infer their attitude. But it's something that I think supervisors should do a lot more work in to try to assess people's attitude and have conversations about it. And I'll close with probably, again, it's the most important, probably the most important of the techniques is to balance confidence with humility. Once you learn that, which comes after a long career, I think, now you have the right attitude about things. And now, even if you do make mistakes, so you asked about Deepwater Horizon long ago, the mistake they made was incorrectly assessing what's known as the negative pressure test. And they made an error in judgment. But the worst failure was not making that mistake. The worst failure was having the confidence that they made the right decision and then never looking at it or questioning that decision again. And there was still, you know, another 48 minutes before the well blew out when they could have seen that the well was beginning to flow and they could have taken actions to stop disastrous consequences. So the point is, they had too much confidence and not enough humility to recognize that you could make a mistake. One of the most common questions we ask ourselves in space is, what mistake have I made? What errors have I introduced? Where have I gone wrong? And how can I correct it before it's too late? That's one of the most profound techniques of operating excellence, is continually challenging yourself to try to identify what mistakes have I made and how can I correct them before it's too late.
How malleable do you think somebody's attitude is?
So the behavioral psychologist will tell you that everything we do in life is based on only two things, the sum total of all my previous experience and my current environment. Well, that's almost too simple to be of any use, because what does that mean? The sum total of all my experience of my entire life. Well, it also answers the question, so I'm going to think about things differently because you and I just had this conversation and I was asked to explain things in certain ways. I'm going to go forth and think about, how did I answer those questions? Can I answer them differently? Your very questions have asked me to think about, you know, and kind of change my attitude. So every day, every way, my attitude changes based on my experiences. So it's another powerful thing that a leader can do, is to help people by giving them new experiences to help them shape their attitude going into the future.
Right. Where can people find out more about you and where can they find your book?
So I have a website. It's www.jimweatherby.com. And as long as they don't put an A in the name Weatherby, then it works. Jim Weatherby, J-I-M-W-E-T-H-E-R-B-E-E.com. that will have my future schedule of engagements that I do. And also, if it's in the U.S., a way for people to purchase a copy of my book, which I autograph all of them. But the other thing is to just, you know, so you can buy the book either through me, through the website, just to know the title of the book, which is Controlling Risk in a Dangerous World. And they can find that book on any of the online internet sites, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, et cetera.
Wonderful.
Of course, it won't come autographed if they go through that route.
So they, and also they would take a bite out of it. So let's go directly to your website if we're in the U.S. and purchase directly. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate that.
Oh, sure. And if anyone's outside the U.S., if they just send me a note on the website, I can figure out a way to send them a book if they decide to purchase it. So it can be done. It's a little bit, takes a little bit longer.
Excellent. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Jim Weatherby. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.